I was about 11 years old, and my family and I, we were driving on a family holiday up to the Gold Coast. I was sleeping in the car at the time, and I remember my mum yell. But this time it wasn't my name or my brother's name. Thankfully, we hadn't done anything wrong, but I heard kangaroo. The whole car kind of jolted, and I heard this loud thud. My brother and I woke up all of a sudden, and we asked what happened. Apparently, we hit a kangaroo. Thankfully, we were all okay, and Dad said he saw the kangaroo coming, but apparently he was going at 100 kilometers per hour, and he couldn't swerve out of the way, because if you swerved, your car would have crashed. And this was also a really expensive car. This was his Mercedes-Benz ML270. This was a car he bought for 100 grand. Well, we lived on the North Shore, so... But the most frustrating thing of all for this trip was that we'd been heading in the wrong direction. The GPS system, navigation system in the car had taken us off the main highway up to the Gold Coast and taken us inland. So we'd been heading the wrong direction. Dad wasn't sure what to do after hitting the kangaroo. He just kept on driving. Apparently what you're supposed to do is pull over, check on the animal and see if it's okay, and call wires and they'll send out a ranger. But we didn't have smartphones back then and we didn't know what to do, so we kept driving. The sky started to lighten up. It was dawn, and so we pulled over at a Macca's pit stop to assess the damage. The whole front panel of the car was smashed in, and the light was also completely shattered. This was apparently a really big kangaroo. So my dad and our family, we went into McDonald's, and we asked for some kind of sellotape because my dad wanted to put some plastic cover over the light to protect it. They gave us some salad because I think they got confused between sellotape and salad, and I think they thought we brought the kangaroo with us. I don't know. So it was a fun and adventurous holiday, and I remember it quite vividly. It was a long drive, but like I said, perhaps the most frustrating thing of all was that we had been going in the wrong direction. The GPS systems were very new at that time, and it had taken us inland. What should have taken 9 hours took 11 hours, and if we hadn't taken that route inland beyond the Blue Mountains Dividing Range, we may have not hit this kangaroo. And we sometimes wonder whether in life we're heading in the right direction, whether I'm doing this whole life thing right, whether I'm doing the right thing, whether I'm headed in the right career direction, whether I'm planning my retirement well, whether I'm raising my kids right. And we may perhaps go to a number of sources to help us define this direction in life. Perhaps to the internet, or we may look at the lives of the people around us and learn from them, perhaps a trusted friend or a family member. People sometimes find direction from philosophers or self-help gurus. Others from whatever the latest trend of the new age spirituality scene is. Many look to organized religion. So where do we find direction? What direction will we choose to take in our lives? And particularly, what does Jesus have to offer for us? And so these are the questions that we're going to be exploring in today's passage. And so I've structured my talk into three sections. Firstly, a sign that Jesus is the light of the world. And secondly, do we want direction? And thirdly, different directions to take. So firstly, a sign that Jesus is the light of the world. A sign that Jesus is the light of the world. So we're going to have a closer look at the passage before us. So let us read from chapter 9, verse 1. So we read, "As he, Jesus, went along, he saw a man blind from birth." So Jesus, he's walking along and he encounters this man who's blind from birth. In those days, they didn't have disability supports or any kind of social welfare. So if you were blind, you were reduced to a life of begging because you couldn't work. And so this man was possibly on the streets begging. And the narrative continues in verse 2. Jesus' disciples, his followers, ask him, "Rabbi," or "teacher," Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Now, this is a very kind of typical way of trying to understand suffering or disease or disability. It was the understanding that this man's blindness was because of a sin that he had committed, or his parents had committed, a kind of karma, you could say. And Jesus responds, as we see in verse 3, Jesus responds, well, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. I've heard a lot of people who have been told that they are suffering because of a particular sin or poor choice of action that they've taken. And now God is punishing them because of what they've done. And now they're suffering. And I want to critique this because this is wrong. And it's a very damaging thing to say. And I'm sorry if anyone has ever said that to you, because they are wrong. But this interaction also brings us this difficult question of suffering. This man, he was born blind and reduced to a life of begging. And the question of suffering is a very difficult question to work through, not only logically, but also emotionally, because we bring a lot of personal baggage to this question. It's a deeply emotional question and a personal question for many of us. For me, I lost my mum to cancer when I was 12. And that family holiday was one of the last we had together. The question of suffering is a very complex one, and one that I won't have time to explore adequately here now. But that's not a cop-out or anything, because the Bible actually talks a lot about suffering. And there are, of course, but I'll say a little bit about this. There are, of course, certain times when poor actions or choices do lead to suffering, and it can be directly attributed. For example, if you do drink excessively, it would destroy your liver. If you were to cheat on your partner, it would destroy your relationship. But there are other parts of the Bible and in life where we cannot attribute a particular type of suffering to a particular poor sin or poor choice of action. Think about childhood and genetic-related cancers. Some motor vehicle accidents. Perhaps it would be at the hands of someone who was using their mobile phone, someone else who was negligent. But you see, all of this suffering, the Bible says, is a symptom of the fallen world that we live in, that is characterized by violence, by disease, and ultimately death. And we know it's wrong because it feels wrong. But for this blind man in the narrative, in this particular instance, his blindness, Jesus says, was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. For this particular situation was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. And as we shall see later, he receives his sight. Let's read on from verse 4. As long as it is day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. After saying this, he spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. Go, he told him, wash in the pool of Siloam. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. On our road trip to the Gold Coast, we saw many signs, many road signs that was pointing us into kind of the right direction and told us how much further we had to go, a couple of thousand kilometres because we got inland. So. But signs are meant to point us in the right direction and point us to the ultimate or true destination and point us to the reality. And I want to help us to see that this healing of the blind man is no different. If you have a closer look at verse 6, it says, after saying this, in other words, after Jesus had said these things, he goes on to heal the blind man, making this healing a sign of what he had said earlier, that he is the light of the world, in verse 5. So this healing or miracle, as we can say, is meant to point to Jesus as the light of the world. This interaction and healing with the blind man, it was very deliberate. Jesus was very deliberate with his words and his actions. The declaration, "I am the light of the world," drives Jesus' interaction with this blind man. So you see, did you notice it? It's very subtle, but it's also very significant. Jesus doesn't say, "I know the way to the light of the world," or "I know the light of the world." But he says, "I am the light of the world." He points to himself. Jesus directs us to himself. "I am the light of the world." And he said stuff that no one would even think of saying. Gautama Buddha, he said, "I know the path or the way to enlightenment. It's through knowing the Four Noble Truths, following the Eightfold Path." Muhammad would have never dared to say anything like this. Instead, he said that the path to God is submission to the will of Allah and following the five pillars of Islam. Some of our modern-day philosophers and self-help gurus say there are these 12 rules to life. And if you follow them, you live well. But Jesus makes an audacious claim. He says, "I am the light of the world." Jesus is claiming and saying that he alone is the source of spiritual light. But this isn't the first time that Jesus says this. What does he mean by it? What does it mean, "I am the light of the world"? So in John 8:12, Jesus says, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Similarly, in John 1, at the very beginning of this gospel, of this biography of Jesus, it says, "He was with God in the beginning." Jesus was with God in the beginning. Through him, through Jesus, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. And the light shines through the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines through the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And if you follow him, whoever walks in darkness will have the light of life. So light's here kind of used as a metaphor, you know, when you walk into a room that's dark, you turn on the light, and it reveals everything that is there in the room. And in a similar way, Jesus is the light of the world. He has come to reveal the truth of God, of who God is. In John 1:18, it says, "No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son," this is Jesus, "who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known." Jesus has come to reveal God. It's the only way we can know God, through his revelation, his revealing to us. And he reveals himself through Jesus Christ. But he's also come to expose the reality of the darkness that we live in, the spiritual darkness, as he comes as a light, as he exposes the spiritual darkness in the world that we live in and in our own hearts as well. This darkness that we see in the world manifests itself in horrible ways. In wars, droughts, bombings, cyclones, floods, gunfire, murder, stealing, genocide, nuclear weapons, chemical warfare, starvation, homelessness, oppression, tears, heartache, depression, sickness, cancer, dementia, greed, lies, blindness, and death. Despite our best efforts, this is the reality of this dark world that we live in. We're in this kind of spiritual darkness that manifests itself in the darkness. And this darkness ultimately stems from our rejection of God, our rejection of the light of the world, our rejection of the goodness and light of God. But the darkness is not just out there. It's not just out there. It's also in our own hearts. And the Bible calls this sin. And so we need a Savior. But you see, God doesn't leave us there in the dark. And he sends his Son Jesus into the world. He came to give us life, a spiritual life, that we may never walk in darkness. And he has come to save us from our own darkness. And he has come to give us life, life with God, eternal life. And we know that our hearts are restless until they find their rest in him. And so if you've come searching today for that light, for someone or something more than that this world offers, Jesus says, I am the light of the world. And whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. And this is an invitation. And on to my second point. Do we want direction? Do we want direction? Have you ever been in a discussion with someone and they're just so kind of fixed on their view, they're not willing to budge or change their opinion and their view, no matter all the evidence that you throw at them and how you try to convince them? I've only been married a few months now, but I found that most of the time, I'm that person. I'm wrong. And I'm sometimes unwilling to budge. But I guess the thing with marriage is that it forces you to compromise and for that person that you love. But you know what I mean. Most of the time, we hold on to positions that we've already made up, that our minds have already come to, and we're not willing to change. Now, this was the same with the Pharisees, who were the Jewish religious leaders at the time, when they kind of investigated the claims of this man who had been born blind. So let's have a look at verse 13 a bit closer. So they brought the Pharisees, the man who had been blind. Now, the day on which Jesus had made the mud and opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath. Therefore, the Pharisees also asked him, how he received his sight. He put mud on my eyes, the man replied, and I washed and now I see. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. But others asked, how can a sinner perform such signs? So they were divided. The response of the Pharisees was that they were divided. It's interesting that this first group of Pharisees, they said that Jesus cannot be God, cannot have healed this man who was blind from birth because he healed on the Sabbath. And the Sabbath was this kind of holy day that God had given to his people as a day of rest so that they weren't supposed to work on that day. It was a day of rest dedicated to God. But the Pharisees, they added all these elaborate rules on top of this, what it meant to rest. So work meant not helping anyone. You're not supposed to help anyone, unless, of course, their life was at risk. The Pharisees said that, you know, the way that Jesus got the little bit of mud and spit on it and kneaded it kind of together was like almost kneading dough or trying to form clay to make pottery. That was work. And so this man had broken the Sabbath. This man had sinned. He's a sinner. And so he cannot have been from God. He cannot have healed this man because he had broken the Sabbath and he is not from God. And so these Pharisees were so fixed on their own rules, their own self-righteous religious rules that they had made. And so they continue to interrogate this man and they even bring his mother and his father to confirm this is actually your son who's been born blind, but now he sees. And so in verse 24, if we keep tracking in the passage, a second time they summon the man who had been blind. Give glory to God by telling the truth, they said. We know this man Jesus is a sinner, he replied. Whether he's a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see. And he goes on in verse 32, nobody has ever heard of anyone opening the eyes of a man born blind. And if this man was not from God, he could do nothing. So this man who had been blind from birth, he cannot deny the reality of what's happened to him. He was blind, he now sees, and he believes truly that if this man healed him, he was from God. But the Pharisees remain firm in their view, in their opinion. Jesus is not from God. He's a sinner. He broke the Sabbath. And I think, like the Pharisees, we don't really realize that most of the time we're really unwilling to change our view or direction on things. Think about our political views or things like climate change, evolution, abortion rights, flat earth views. We're often unwilling to change on things. Jonathan Haidt, who's a social psychologist at NYU, argues that one of the reasons that we're unwilling to change is because of an evolutionary kind of bias of group tribalism. So we like to identify with groups that have a similar view to us, and we don't want to budge, and we like to fit in that group. And this is, of course, fueled by social media in our modern day and age, where this kind of mob mentality makes it easier to even normal to attack and shame someone. And it's because certain algorithms work on Facebook and Twitter that continue to feed you what you click on. And because of these kind of group tribalistic instincts, there's something that's called the backfire effect, that when a particular view challenges our view, we tend to just kind of dig our heels in a little bit more and react to it. And so we don't want to change. And of course, there are many other reasons as well, such as ego defense, pride in thinking that we're right. But this kind of understanding can be seen in our justice systems. For example, when police have a suspect for a crime, they often stop pursuing other suspects and start looking for reasons why this particular suspect that is in custody did it. Why don't they start looking for reasons why he didn't do it, he or she didn't do it? Because once they have a suspect, they try to build the case around the suspect. And as we know, there have been a number of cases throughout history where they've got the wrong person. Because it's often very difficult for us to rise above our own biases. We often demand much more and perhaps much more critical of views that run contrary to ours. We often try to make arguments fit what we already believe. And of course, this argument runs both ways for the Christian and the non-Christian. But there's this funny story which I think illustrates a little bit of this point. It's a story of a man who is convinced that he is dead. I don't know if you heard it, but his wife and his children try to convince him that he's not dead. He believes he's dead. They tell him, you know, you're walking, you're talking, you're breathing. How are you dead? But he still remains adamant and firm that he is dead. And so they take him to the family doctor. The family doctor, you know, starts taking his heart rate and oxygen levels and shows him all these results. And he says, in fact, you're quite healthy. You're not dead. But then He still remains firm. He's like, I'm dead. The doctor brings out a medical textbook and he shows him, well, dead people don't bleed. Dead people don't bleed. And the man takes a little while and he becomes convinced, okay, yes, you're right, dead people don't bleed. So this man who believes he's dead also believes that dead people don't bleed. The doctor takes his hand, puts a pin to it, he starts bleeding and he looks at his hand, shocked. Oh my goodness, he says. What do you know? Dead people do bleed. Perhaps listening to the story of the blind man being healed sounds a little bit of a stretch. It's hard to take seriously, and I completely understand that, because when you see people being healed, when you see people going around putting mud on people's eyes and they can see, because aren't miracles by definition a violation of the laws of nature? Miracles cannot happen by definition. And so this is kind of the same sentiment that a couple of guys last term expressed with the Christian Explored course we were running. And it's a really common experience, I think, for many people, the problem of miracles. Because these guys, you know, they said that this couldn't have happened, and so the disciples and Jesus must have staged everything. They must have got together, collaborated, made up this whole story. These guys believe that miracles couldn't happen, and so they tried to explain it in a way that fits their worldview, a naturalistic worldview. Miracles don't happen. And so I wanted to help them to see, but if Jesus is God, could he have healed the man? If Jesus was God, could he have performed all these miracles? And they said, well, yeah. I mean, if Jesus is God, then he can do anything he wants. It was perhaps the first time, particularly for one of them, where it opened up the possibility that Jesus was God, that Jesus is the light of the world. And he started to ask more questions and examine more of the evidence. And rightly so, because this is a huge claim. You see, Jesus offers us a spiritual light, a direction. But do we want direction? My third and final point. Different directions to take. So track with me at verse 35 again. In the passage, Jesus heard that they had thrown him out. That is the blind man. They'd thrown him out of the synagogue. And when he had found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" "Who is he, sir?" the man asked. "Tell me so that I may believe in him." Jesus said, "You have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you." Then the man said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshipped him. You see, we see different responses of people with Jesus. So for this blind man, this is the first time that he lays eyes on Jesus. Jesus asks him if he believes in the Son of Man. That was kind of Jesus' way of his own self-identification. He referred to himself as the Son of Man. And this man says he wants to believe. He wants to believe this man who had healed him. And he wants to put his trust in the Son of Man. And so Jesus says, "I am he." And he heals him. Oh, sorry. And he says, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped Jesus. Meanwhile, some of the Pharisees, the religious leaders, they say, Jesus said in verse 35, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." When Jesus comes as the light of the world, for some, like the Pharisees, they don't want to see it. They consider their own wisdom, their own illumination enough. And they refuse to look closely, and their hearts are closed. But there are some who recognize their own spiritual blindness, their own spiritual darkness, and they come and have a closer look at Jesus. And they see that he is the light of the world. It was the late Stephen Hawking who criticized Christianity, saying that Christianity is a fairy story for those who are afraid of the dark. Professor John Lennox, an Oxford mathematician, was asked to respond to this, and he said, "Well, if that's the case, then atheism is a fairy story for those afraid of the light." And he goes on, it's funny, but he said this kind of mockery doesn't get us anywhere. We need to look at the evidence. We need to look at the truth claim. You see, people can come to very polarizing views of Jesus. For some, the light of Jesus can be blinding. and we don't want to look at it. Others step into that light and say, maybe I'll give it a try. Maybe I'll do what he says and give this God thing a go. And as they step into that light, they discover that there is this God, and I am more than what I see. And that's certainly true of me. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. If this is true, it changes everything. It changes this world from some kind of meaningless chaos into a world that is designed and purposeful, where there is a direction, where Jesus is the light of the world, and we need to follow this light. If this is all new to you, I hope you open up yourself to the possibility that Jesus could be God, that Jesus is the light of the world. And one of the best ways to do it is the Christian Explored course. I've run a number of them over the years, and it's just such a great environment to explore Jesus and explore the Christian message in environments that's not hostile, that you can be genuine and ask questions. There's no such thing as a dumb question in these events. And so I really encourage you to take up that opportunity to do Christian Explored, if that's you. But I want to end with a story of a man whose life's direction was changed by the light of Jesus, and I think it's very inspirational. So John Newton was a slave trader in the 1700s until he converted to Christianity, and it took him a little while to leave that trade behind. And he recalls some of the horrors of shipping men across the ocean, and so many of them died. But John Newton left that behind and eventually became a minister. He wrote many, many hymns. He was a minister at St. Mary Woolnorth in London, and he ministered to many of the poor and the merchant class of that city. But as well as that, he ministered to many of the wealthy and influential, one of who was William Wilberforce. William was a member of Parliament at the time, and he was strongly influenced by John's teaching and life. And William was considering a move out of Parliament and into the ministry. But John Newton convinced him, no, stay in Parliament, stay and influence and make changes for the good of this nation, for the good of people. And so William Wilberforce dedicated his entire life's mission and goal to the abolition of slavery. 26 years after John Newton died and 1 month after William Wilberforce died, the Slavery Abolition Act was passed in 1833. And there's a particular hymn that John Newton wrote that I think captures his life well, that captures this kind of message of this blind man well, and I think relates well to my own life as well. It's a familiar hymn, so I'm going to sing it. No, I'm not going to sing it. I'm going to read it. It's Amazing Grace. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found. 'Twas blind, but now I see.